Can you explain to me what bariatric surgery is?
It's an umbrella term for a number of operations that we do on the gut, mainly the stomach and the small intestine. And ultimately what they end up doing is changing how the gut talks to the brain.
Could you just explain why obesity is considered to be a chronic illness and it isn't just people being lazy and slovenly and eating too much and moving too little?
Yeah.
If a surgery takes an hour and a half, why aren't there 30 or 40 being done a week? What do you think of the 360 surgeries?
So the 360 kind of abdominoplasty would be for...
Welcome to my podcast, The Laura Dowland Experience. Many of you will know me from my Instagram page at Fabulous Pharmacist, where I love to shine a light on topics that people normally shy away from. Today, I spoke with Professor Helen Heenan. Helen is a bariatric or weight loss surgeon. We spoke about the different types of bariatric surgery, how changes in the gut hormones and microbiome affect weight loss. We spoke about the side effects of surgery, obesity care and management, the long waiting lists and the expensive treatment in Ireland. And we also discussed surgery abroad. This was such an informative podcast and I learnt so much just sitting listening to Helen. I could listen to her for hours. This podcast is brought to you today by Boyne Valley Honey. As Ireland's favourite honey brand, Boyne Valley Honey have been spreading sunshine across the country for generations. This year, we're excited to announce that Boyne Valley Honey have partnered with Pieta House to officially become the 2024 Breakfast Partner of Darkness into Light. Pick up a limited edition Darkness into Light squeezy Boyne Valley Honey in stores across the country or follow at Boyne Valley Honey on Instagram to find out how you can support the most important sunrise of the year. Ladies, have you bought your tickets yet for Viva La Volva Dublin? Viva La Volva is coming to Dublin. It's coming to the National Concert Hall on May the 5th for the final stop of our tour. This is your last chance to experience a women's health event like no other. Myself and my esteemed panel of experts will deliver 3 hours of empowerment, education and laughter as we delve into important and often taboo discussions surrounding women's health and sexuality. The ticket price is €75. This includes a complimentary, amazing goodie bag worth well over €120, jam-packed, full of two Fab U products. Marissa Carter is donating some Cocoa Brown. We have the Neutrogena Retinol range. AU Beauty are giving a tan and their amazing concealer. Nux are giving some Nux Nuxuriance. We have Aveeno body care and hair care. And we have Thea eye care. Tickets are available on www.nch.ie. That is the National Concert Hall website. See you there. Professor Helen Heenan, I am so glad to have you here today.
Thank you so much, Laura. I'm delighted to be here.
You are a bariatric surgeon.
Yes.
And judging from the amount of questions that come in, I just put up a question box this morning. There are hundreds and hundreds of questions in there. People are very interested in this topic.
I'm delighted to hear that. Yeah, I'm surprised people, I suppose it still surprised me that as many people are familiar with these surgeries. I think that's a really positive thing that's evolved over the last few years with an interest in obesity treatment.
I think
awareness of bariatric surgery has increased. I think that's great.
Yeah. Some people thought I said barbaric surgeon and they were like, oh, that piqued my interest. And oh, I realised it was bariatric.
Yeah.
So you're not barbaric by any means.
I don't think so.
Can you explain to me what bariatric surgery is?
So it's an umbrella term for a number of operations that we do on the gut, different parts of the gut, mainly the stomach and the small intestine. And ultimately what they end up doing is changing how the gut talks to the brain. So a lot of patients would wake up and feel like you operated on their brain and ask if you did, you know, feel like that you've turned off a switch in their brain. But through manipulating different parts of the gut, you can completely change the way the gut and the brain communicate. And that has an impact on weight regulation. So they are technically obesity operations. They help people lose a significant amount of weight, but they also do other things that are, you know, not directly related to weight. So they're excellent for the treatment of diabetes, the treatment of cancer in some instances, like womb cancer, treatment of blood pressure, cholesterol, heart disease, sleep disorder, breathing. So they have a knock-on effect on any condition basically that's linked to obesity or an obesity complication, can be, for a lot of them, put into remission by bariatric surgery, and for others is significantly improved.
Wow. And what kind of surgeries are, what are the differences in the surgeries?
Yeah, there's a few different types. So I suppose the two commonest operations that we would do would be gastric bypass and a sleeve gastrectomy. So their operations, gastric bypass would be the one we could do the most often. I'd say 80% of what I do is gastric bypass surgery. So this is the room-wide gastric bypass. So that involves making the stomach smaller. So I like to compare the size of the stomach to, when I'm talking to patients, to a rugby ball. It's similar in length and width if you were to blow it up fully with air fluid. So we make that into about the size of a small fist. So about 50 mils would, you know, capacity if it wasn't distended. So separate a small piece of the stomach from the main body of the stomach and then rearrange the intestine. So bring a piece of the intestine that's lower down in someone's GI tract now and stitch it up to that new stomach pouch. So food essentially takes a shortcut downstream. With the gastric bypass, we don't remove any stomach. The old stomach stays in, it stays healthy, its blood supply comes into it from the other side. So it's just permanently rested. So we permanently rest about 80-85% of the stomach and the first half a metre of small bowel. And that's a large part of how the operation works as well as it does. By resting the foregut, you get a significant change in lots of gut hormones that are important in weight regulation. So in appetite, satiety, which is the feeling of fullness we have, either with or especially after food. It also changes how the pancreas produces insulin, how the rest of the body responds to that insulin. Changes gut microbiome.
And I was going to say, does it change that for the positive or a negative?
Because, for the positive, So it can change the gut microbiome even within, before someone has lost weight, to the microbiome of a lean person. So that's really interesting. Now, I think the science around microbiome after bariatric surgery is, it's not fully elucidated yet, but there's certainly, you know, emerging data that it's an important part of how these operations work.
I never knew any of this. I literally just thought you halved the stomach
and there you was less.
Yeah, and you ate less as a result. But it's all to do with all of this as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So certainly people do eat less, but that's not how the operations work. They're, you know, it's generally, and we tried for a while calling them metabolic operations to try and make that distinction.
Yeah.
You know, aside from bariatric operations, they're essentially the same thing. Mm-hmm. They work through changing gut hormones for the most part. And a good example, one of the hormones that changes significantly after a gastric bypass is GLP-1. And a lot of people might be familiar with that. That's the hormone that Ozempic or Victoza tries to replicate. So those drugs that are really important parts of weight management and help people with weight loss and diabetes, they are increase the your body's natural GLP-1 hormone. They're a man-made form of it, essentially.
Yeah.
So bariatric surgery naturally increases your levels of those hormones to make you feel full and to decrease appetite. So then the sleeve gastrectomy, the other operation, about 20% of our volume involves removing 3/4 of the stomach. And that works slightly differently. So it's interesting, again, a lot of people, and we did for years, think that was a purely restrictive operation. It reduced the capacity of the stomach by, you know, 4/5. So it reduced intake. But actually, again, it's a chemical, it's a metabolic operation. The part of the stomach that we remove makes most of our hunger hormone, which is called ghrelin. So when we remove that, again, within hours, your body's level of hunger hormone is massively decreased. So again, people wake up and they're not hungry at all. Like they've no interest in food or often fluid as well. So that's the main mechanism by which a sleeve gastrectomy works. It also causes an increase in GLP-1 and all these other gut hormones that a bypass would also affect. So they're really powerful operations that work not just by making the stomach smaller.
Well, I have learned something new today. And how do you decide who gets one or the other?
Oh, it's, again, it's not it's not a perfect science. Sometimes patient choice is really important actually there. So someone has to live with these operations. And I really like when a patient comes in and says, you know, I'm most interested in a bypass or a sleeve. And then, you know, and a lot of people will have, people are so educated now when they come and, mm-hmm. and have, and they've received the information, I suppose, over their journey to having a surgical discussion, that they will have an interest often in one operation or over another, or will have already been guided. There's a few rules, I suppose, that I use in trying to help somebody make that decision. You can't do a gastric bypass for everybody. So some people with very severe obesity, you know, probably 200 kilos plus, that it's not always, it depends on BMI and where people hold their weight, but the more severe the abdominal obesity is, sometimes they just don't have the room or the space inside to move the bowel around the way that I need it to. Okay. So sometimes a higher BMI, like 60 plus BMI, the body mass index, you know, which most people would be familiar with that term now, again, it's a relationship of if someone isn't height and weight, but a BMI of 60 plus probably often won't have enough space to do a bypass. And then a sleeve is one of the few options somebody has then. Sometimes in those instances, we can do two operations. So a sleeve initially, and when the sleeve has helped somebody to lose a significant amount of weight, you can do another operation like a bypass, or in some instances, a bigger operation called a duodenal switch, that we actually don't do it at the moment, but, you know, have the skill set to do it, and we'll do select number of them over the next few years to help people lose more weight or improve their health further. So for people who can't have a bypass, they have, you know, the default option is a sleeve. People who've had a lot of abdominal surgery before for any number of reasons, including sometimes hernia surgery, mesh, where they might cause small bowel adhesions or mesh, bowel to stick to mesh, the bowel may not be mobile enough to do a bypass. So you need the bowel to be, the first 2 meters of bowel to be very mobile to be able to move it around.
And Helen is like waving her hand around here for anyone that's not watching the video, like as if your bowel just like waves around in the
Yeah, pretty much. So like I said, bypass would be my preference for a lot of people, because they're result is a little bit better for weight, in terms of the amount of weight lost in the short term, medium and long term would be slightly greater than the sleeve, only in the order of about 3-5% of someone's preoperative weight. Mm-hmm. But for some, that small amount can be important, but there's certainly less weight regain after a bypass compared to a sleeve. So, you know, obesity is a chronic disease and you can't cure it, but these are really good tools that help to treat it, and the bypass will be more powerful than the sleeve in that regard in the long term. Okay. So a sleeve is still a really good option for people, but about 1 in 5 can regain the weight over the course of their lifetime afterwards.
Okay, so a bypass, 1 in 5 can or do?
Do, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I suppose all people who have obesity, you know, are at risk of weight regain no matter what, you know, a treatment approach is used, be that diet and lifestyle changes, medication. If you stop any of the obesity medications, inevitably the weight will be regained. And similar with surgery, there's some operations where weight regain is instant. For example, a gastric band, if you remove it, weight regain will happen. Gastric balloon, which is, you know, another very short-term type of obesity treatment, you remove that, the weight will go back on very quickly. But a gastric bypass, the weight regain rate is quite low. Because it's such a powerful operation.
Do people ever get it reversed?
You can reverse the bypass. I would, and sometimes people like the idea that it's reversible, that something isn't removed. I would tend to not use that as a benefit of it, although it is a comfort to people to know that there's nothing removed from their body. It's just moved around. So I suppose in the last 6 years, I've probably reversed more. Two for different reasons. Sometimes people, it's very rare someone would get malnutrition after bariatric surgery, but it is possible if someone just absolutely doesn't follow the kind of nutritional advice given, and that includes not just with regards to what they eat, so eating healthy food like protein in particular, but with their supplements. So there's a strict regime someone has to follow after bariatric surgery with regards to vitamins to stay nourished, given that they're eating essentially so little. So to stay well in the long term requires, you know, important dietary advice and adhering to that, and then nutritional supplements, as well as monitoring levels of vitamins over the course of their lifetime.
And they need to take those supplements for the rest of their life, do they? Okay.
Yeah.
And then how much food can they eat? So how many calories do they roughly eat a day?
We try and get people to move away from the diet culture counting calories, but some people, it's so ingrained in patients by the time they come to us that they kind of obsess over how many calories they're eating at different time points. By about 6 weeks after these surgeries, people are, you know, only able to manage about 600 to 800 calories. That's all they would fit over the course of a day. So a meal size in the first, say, 3 months would be about a ramekin dish, you know, and they, for the first 6 weeks, they may not finish that. They'll be, you know, pretty stuffed on half a ramekin dish of porridge in the morning, or half a Weetabix, maybe one egg, a scrambled egg. That would be, you know, a filling meal for somebody after surgery. But they would, you know, many patients tell me they can still enjoy it as they have to take their time eating it.
Can they feel get sick quite quickly, or
it can? If, and this is where preparation for bariatric surgery is so important, to avoid vomiting frequently. So people have to eat quite slowly because the stomach is so small. They have to eat and drink separately. If you eat and drink at the same time after after bariatric surgery, there isn't room for both, you know. So people can, I suppose, get sick easily if they rush their meals. And most of us are used to rushing our food really, really quickly. So people would have to spend 20 minutes over a ramekin dish, you know, for it to sit comfortably. So really encourages mindful eating. And then that also facilitates, you know, feeling full from the food, given that it takes that long to eat it and allows the satiety signals to enter someone's consciousness.
And will they absorb alcohol much quicker? So as a result, could get drunker quicker?
So we would recommend people don't drink for at least 3 months after surgery, just to, I suppose, first of all, adjust to eating and drinking, eating and drinking normally. And that is a huge, huge adjustment. And, you know, that's something people have to be prepared for, or they really struggle with otherwise. So, you know, even when patients are prepared to eat slowly and they've prepared all their ramekin dishes of food and, you know, they have really put a lot of effort into preparing, they can still, you know, it's still difficult to adjust to that. And sometimes people are eating, you know, when they don't have no interest in doing so, you know, so they have to really, you know, eat by the clock or set alarms and reminders to make sure they get their intake for the day. So alcohol, we try and say, look, leave that for at least 3 months. And then when people do drink, I would always tell somebody that, you know, their tolerance for whatever they could drink is going to be at least halved. So to be you know, cautious when reintroducing alcohol. There's a lot of people, a lot of types of fluid that people can't manage after surgery, like a fizzy drink, for, you know, so anything that's carbonated would be really challenging. It could hurt by a sudden stretch on the stomach. So, you know, there's a, and then the volume of drink, like, you know, particularly for some men who are pint drinkers beforehand, you know, that, and about 35% of our volume of our bariatric patients would be men. So, you know, there's largely the people who undergo bariatric surgery, there's a huge female predominance. And I don't know, is that because weight bothers them in different ways, but they come forward for bariatric surgery and for weight treatment sooner than men. And by the time men come or get referred, they're often much sicker and heavier than women would be when they attend for present for surgery or are referred for surgery. So yeah, pint drinking is something that someone can't do anymore. They literally just don't have the room for it. So there is a big adjustment to, you know, or difference in someone's relationship with alcohol after surgery, for sure.
And does the stomach ever stretch back afterwards?
I don't know. Like, we, when someone regains weight afterwards, we would would almost always investigate for that. I've never seen it. So you wonder if, you know, especially if you didn't do the first operation, was it left that way in the first instance? So sometimes it'd go back in after a sleeve gastrectomy intending to change it to a bypass, and actually this sleeve is pretty big, you know, anyway. Okay. So there's a lot of things we now do to avoid leaving, you know, too much stomach behind or not. And same for a gastric bypass. We perform the stomach resection or the gastric pouch creation over what we call a bootie, a sizing tube, to make sure that it's neither too big. And it would also be pretty bad if you met it too small. So people would have no quality of life if you met the stomach too small. So there's ways and means about making sure you do a good quality operation so you don't leave the stomach too big in the first instance. But I don't think I've ever really seen the stomach stretch out. You know, I think actually, again, a bit like, you know, they're not restrictive operations in the first instance. I don't think weight regain is caused by an increase in the size of the stomach. I think actually what we'd often see is that people have adjusted to around the operation. So they might take in a lot of liquid or meltable calories again.
Okay. You know,
so there is certainly a resurgence of hunger about 2 years after the operation in some people, where, you know, again, obesity is a chronic disease. And, you know, it's
actually probably worthwhile explaining what it is, just in case anyone didn't listen to the My Mick Crotty podcast that I did about 18 months ago.
Yeah.
Could you just explain why obesity is considered to be a chronic illness and it isn't just people being lazy and slovenly and eating too much and moving too little?
Yeah, and Mick will have explained this far more eloquently than I will. But it's now acknowledged for over a decade that obesity is a chronic disease. It's not just a risk factor for other diseases like heart disease and blood pressure. So it's absolutely not a lack of willpower. So obesity stems from a disorder in the hypothalamus, which is a part of the brain that we have no voluntary control over. So it's very similar to your temperature. You can't will yourself to be hotter or cooler. You have to physically do something about it, like open a window, put on clothes, take off clothes to achieve that. So the fact that, you know, it's involuntary controlled by the hypothalamus indicates that it's not something that's within your voluntary control to manipulate. So obesity is a disease of that part of the hypothalamus where weight regulation is broken, for want of a better term. So what we see is that there isn't appropriate communication between the gut and the brain. So gut hormones would regulate the part of the hypothalamus that's responsible for weight regulation. And by that I mean would regulate appetite and the body's weight set point. And that's why manipulating gut hormones through using semaglutide or liraglutide or through surgery is such a powerful treatment for obesity.
Can you just explain what weight set point is to the listeners, please?
Yeah, so I suppose it's interesting. We all have a weight set point, which, and people who've dieted over the years will often see that in the first, you know, month or 6 weeks or so, they can easily drop, you know, a stone or two stone. But then as life happens and, you know, the diet that was probably not sustainable that they're on the first instance as kind of habits and that or the diet ends or life evolves and, you know, over time that diet ends, the body weight will come back to almost the same weight that they started at, and often a little bit higher, because there's no better way to gain weight than to diet. You know, dieting is particularly very restrictive or very low calorie dieting will slow metabolic rate largely through losing muscle mass. So if you lose weight very quickly, some of the weight that you've lost won't be just fat, it'll be some of your muscle, and that's directly related to your metabolic rate. That's how your body burns energy. So that slows down. So your body, it defends your weight as strongly as it defends, you know, anything like your blood count or your temperature. You know, your body, I suppose, because it sees it as a threat to your health if you try to lose weight. So it'll try and counteract that by decreasing the amount of energy it burns on an hourly rate. And it'll evolve to make you hungrier. That's why you can, you know, voluntarily control what you eat, you know, for a very short period of time. But after that, the involuntary signals of hunger will kick in. And make you ravenous. You know, I don't know if anybody diets, all you think about is, you know, all people will think about is food.
Yeah.
What's next? What can I have? You know, so it's all consuming. And that's actually coming from part of the brain that's trying to protect you against weight loss and defend your body weight set point. Now, a few things change the body weight set point for the worse, so will increase it over the years. So some of the things that are known, some medications, lack of sleep.
Sleep is so important, isn't it? In obesity management even and weight loss management, it is so important that people get their sleep.
Absolutely. And we would often see people, you know, who do a lot of night shifts and that would, not everybody obviously who does night shifts will gain weight, but many do. And certainly if we're operating on people and they, you know, are somebody who does a lot of night work or night shifts, we would advise them to see if there's any way they can change that, because the circadian rhythm is completely disrupted when people work nights or have disrupted sleep. And correcting that is an important part of weight regulation.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of those things can increase your weight set point over time. And, you know, some of the best examples of the weight set points that I can remember over the last few years is we, through our weight management program in Lachlanstown, have part for certain patients with very severe and complex obesity, we have an inpatient weight management program where we will admit, as this is led by Donal O'Shea and Jean O'Connell, but you know, and they would admit patients for 6 weeks. And essentially someone would have only milk. So they'd have a very low calorie diet, but what they consume is milk, about 6 pints of milk a day. So that's quite low calories. You know, it's about 700, between 700 and 800 calories a day. And that's it. No solid food and nothing other than milk. Milk is a really nourishing food. You know, if it's good enough for babies, it's good enough for adults.
So we should all be breastfed till we're adults, shouldn't we?
Yeah. So mostly on that, people would lose significant amounts of weight. We've had some patients gain weight on that, in that program. So they're, you know, they're not getting food in. There's no, you know, there's no way of, there's no cheating on it. There's no, you know, they literally, their metabolic rate and or their metabolism is so broken that they are only burning about, despite their high body weight, only burning that amount of calories a day. So, you know, everybody's body weight set point is different. And what, you know, the one thing about diet and lifestyle changes as a, you know, they're not a good treatment for very severe obesity. They do not reset the weight set point at all. In fact, they probably increase it somewhat. Okay. And drugs like Ozempic or Wegovy, so that's semaglutide, they can decrease the body weight set point in some people, but only about probably 1 in 3, only whilst on the drug as well. And then surgery can reset that weight set point down by about 25%.
Okay.
Again, and that's usually a durable decrease in the weight set point. So, you know, people would drop their body is tricked into thinking it should be 25% lighter than it was before the operation.
Okay.
You know, and a good analogy to the body weight set point would be, you know, if you get your hemoglobin. So most of our hemoglobins are set to be between, say, for a female 12 to 14 or a male 13 to 15. And if either of us donate a pint, say your hemoglobin, Laura, is 12.5 today and you donate a unit of blood this evening, you know, within 2 weeks, your blood count will be back up to 12.5. You won't have you won't have done anything. You don't even have to take really the iron supplements that you'll be given. But your body, or your body will defend your hemoglobin quite tightly, and it's the very same with your temperature as well, and same with your weight. And all that is involuntary. You don't have to think about that.
Yeah.
So your weight is not under your voluntary control. And I think, you know, that's a long answer to the question about obesity as a chronic disease.
Yeah, but I
think
it's really, really important, because I think there still is that school of thought out there that people are just lazy.
Yeah,
and why is
not.
It called a chronic disease? Because they ate their way to that disease.
Absolutely,
you know.
Not,
so
you know.
I think it's important to establish that. What got you into all this? You know, because you're obviously, as a bariatric surgeon, it's quite nichey.
Yeah, very.
So
very,
I'm interested, you know, as to why you got interested in the whole weight loss management.
Yeah, there was no career path specifically for it when I went through surgical training, but I've always had an interest in weight and the regulation of it. I think since probably before medical school even. And I think when, you know, most bariatric surgeons and people who work in weight management have that interest in, probably a personal interest in it that evolves then into a career interest as well. And again, I remember being, I'm not sure if, you know, any of my family even remember this, but I remember being a, you know, chubby kind of 10, 11, 12 year old. And the first thing that, like, I remember a time being conscious about weight and overweight was, I remember we're typical Irish twins. I have a brother who's, you know, a year older, and we were in the same class together. And in sixth class, I remember being put on the boys' tug of war team as a reflection of being, you know, chubby and strong. And I remember it was the first time it dawned on me now, being half proud that I was selected over my brother to be on the team, but it wasn't for my strength, you know, it was for, and I was remember it dawning on me that, and again, as a child, it was kind of a, you know, sad realization yeah. that you're overweight. But I remember from that day, probably had a kind of an unhealthy relationship with weight at the time for about 6 or 7 years.
Okay.
And then just became interested in it as how weight relates to health over the course of medical school and then as a junior doctor. And I do remember with regards to bariatric surgery, I think I was an intern at the time in Galway, and Professor McInnena, Oliver McInnena there was, you know, an amazing surgeon, one of those, you know, we're so subspecialised now that, you know, bariatric surgery is almost all of what I do. And, you know, two decades ago, surgeons did, you know, everything from upper GI surgery, lower GI surgery. And Professor McEnena was one of those who, you know, he's a colorectal surgeon, upper GI surgeon. And he one day was doing an obesity. So he was one of only two surgeons in Ireland at the time. Him and Justin Gagan took on some obesity operations, you know, for very severe obesity, very complex obesity at the time. And there was such a circus around this case going on that, you know, half the, all the surgical department knew about it. And, you know, I did too. And I wanted to go and, you know, see what it was like. So I remember going into theatre that day and I had no reason to be there other than, again, I was interested, but so were 30 other people. But I thought it struck me that most people's interest was for the wrong reason. It just was the spectacle of doing an obesity operation. And I remember just the first time felt incredible, just overwhelming empathy for the patient who was in such a vulnerable position, getting a treatment that would inevitably, you know, lengthen his life and better it. But it just was my first exposure to bariatric surgery. But it really sparked an interest in me that I, you know, it was insatiable from that point onwards. So that was the first exposure. And again, it just evolved from there. It was on a path that was leading me towards being kind of a breast cancer surgeon at the time. That was the aspiration that I had. And then I remember a year in Finamed, we got the professor of surgery that started in Galway that time, Michael Kern, who's my mentor. He's amazing. He's a breast surgeon. And when he's, you know, I remember him just bounding down the stairs on his first day to, we were, it was our first day of Finamed. And he just had so much energy and passion. He was like, isn't life great, was his first word. And, you know, isn't surgery just the most wonderful career? And like most people didn't really think it was a great career prospect in while we were Finamed. But I remember just thinking, wow, you know, he loved his job so much. And I just thought, gosh, that's what I want to be like. You know, just he had such enthusiasm and passion for what he did that I thought, gosh, if he gets, you know, just it sparked something in me that just made me think, yeah, surgery is possible. I never thought, I never remember thinking that I couldn't do it, even though there was no female role models at the time. Or
tricky enough career for a female, just in terms of like the amount of time it takes to get qualified, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose not the only one, but yeah, there wasn't not a lot of females said. Chosen to go down that career path. And yeah, I got loads of advice saying not to do it, that it was too difficult, too hard. You couldn't, you know, at the time it didn't bother me, wasn't interested in it, but that, you know, wasn't compatible with having a family and things like that. Mm-hmm. Which I'm glad, you know, I didn't listen to any of that. That didn't relate to me at the time. But yeah, he just inspired me to firstly to pursue a career in surgery. And then it was that experience observing an obesity operation at the time that just, and a history, you know, a history of, I suppose, being interested in, and, you know, in some way, I suppose, yeah, that personal interest in just managing weight, that, again, a lot of bariatric surgeons have some personal interest about it. So, yeah, it sparked an interest that then evolved over seeking out a couple of years in Cleveland, where they probably was one of the best, I think it was the best bariatric surgery centre in the US at that time anyway, was performing about 700 bariatric operations a year. So I went there for a couple of years at the very beginning of my surgical training and then came back, and there was no career path here again for bariatric surgery. So I fell back into general surgery and breast surgery again. And it just never was, you know, I probably would have been content, you know, with a career as a breast surgeon, but it just never, towards the latter 2 years of training, I just couldn't get it out of my head. And there was still no prospect of a job in it back here. But I thought I'd do one more year in the UK at the end of training to see, is this what I really, I just loved it. You know, I couldn't, really? Yeah. So I wouldn't have been, I think, truly happy doing anything else. And I do remember getting, again, it's all the role models I've had in surgery over my career, short as it is to date, have been men. But I remember, you know, Oscar Traynor, again, another Irish surgical legend. He gave me one bit of advice early on in my training. It was like, you know, forget about what your head tells you to do. You know, and he wasn't a man I expected to say that, but he said, you know, do follow your heart with regards to career choice. It's a long career and you have to really love doing it. Yeah. So I thought of him quite a few times when I was trying to make that decision. I'm really glad I did. A job, you know, evolved, the job I currently have materialised whilst I was in the UK, the job I first took when I came to Vincent's materialised as the first public bariatric surgeon. You know, that was, it was the first job dedicated to doing that.
And you got that first position?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And that was, you know, that job was 10 years or 15 years in the making. It was Donal O'Shea and my colleague Justin Gagan who, I suppose, demonstrated the need for it. And, you know, it was years of work on their part in acknowledging the size of the waiting list and that lobbied for the funding for the job to happen.
What were people doing prior to that, going to England?
There's always been a waiting list for bariatric surgery, despite there being no service really. So there was a real ad hoc service where Justin Gagan would, you know, he's a surgeon who did loads of things from liver transplant to GI surgery. And Justin was doing about maybe 20 cases a year over the previous decade, just for the most severe and complex obesity. Through his, you know, relationship, he worked in Loughlinstown for general surgery, and, you know, Donal O'Shea leading the weight management clinic from there asked Justin one day, could he do these operations just to get some people off the waiting list? And Justin was like, sure, no problem. And he learned how to do it himself and just was able to, you know, dedicate an odd one of his operating lists to doing this. But it was so ad hoc, and it wasn't funded actually. It was just Loughlinstown, the St. Columbkills Hospital and Vincent's, you know, dedicated some funding locally to doing that, but it wasn't funded programmatically. Or, you know, there was no dedicated investment in it from the government or from the Department of Health. That only came actually 2 years ago. So it's taken a lot, like two decades of, you know, or essentially Donal, I suppose his whole career has led to achieving programmatic funding for obesity treatments to treat severe obesity.
And what's the waiting list like? You mentioned that dreaded two words.
It's still terrible. It's about 6 years, I suppose, from referral to an operation.
When
at
you
the
think
moment.
How sick someone is, if they need it, and then they're waiting 6 years. Can you explain how to get there?
Yeah, and we have, you know, I should say we have made a lot of progress over the last 5 to 6 years, and particularly in the last two, to getting programmatic, a commitment from the Department of Health to fund bariatric surgery, to fund a lot of obesity treatments. So weight management clinics where all treatments will be discussed and available to people, including surgery. So that has, there has been an agreement to fund that system programmatically. So what that would mean is guaranteed funding for, you know, eventually up to 1,200 bariatric surgery operations across the country per year. We are so far from that at the moment, you know, but we're doing about 200 operations a year now in Vincent's, and that was only 20 6 years ago. So there's a major, you know, that's a massive improvement.
How many hours roughly does a surgery take?
Only an hour.
Okay.
You know, so a sleeve is a pretty quick operation. That's about 40, 45 minutes. And a bypass would take about an hour, sometimes up to an hour and a half.
Okay.
But on average, about an hour and 10 minutes.
Okay.
And I'm slow. So, you know, my colleague, you know, some of my
guys
would be
slow
faster.
And careful though than someone who's quick.
So an hour and 10.
Okay.
To do it. To deal with the surgical waiting list. And again, this is a very, you know, Irish solution to an Irish problem. We took some of the skilled staff who were preparing people through the weight management clinics in St. Columbkills to get people ready for surgery and follow people up after surgery. So we didn't increase the number of staff until last year, really. So it led to, you know, it wasn't a similar increase in the number of people coming through the entry point to the program. So just to explain to you, if someone's referred for bariatric surgery, they go, you know, through the letter of referral goes to the weight management clinic in St. Columbkills Hospital, even if it's addressed to me, to Dear Helen, you know, please see this patient with regards to bariatric surgery.
And so that's their GP would refer in. Okay.
So we funnel everybody through the weight management clinic, because sometimes, even though people might meet the criteria for surgery, and I can explain what they are, you know, based on weight and health issues, but it still may not be the right treatment for them, you know, either at that time or ever. And that's an important job of the multidisciplinary team to establish if, you know, a life-changing treatment like bariatric surgery is indeed, you know, the right thing for somebody. Because in some instances, it can be detrimental to someone's health and to their life to have these operations if you completely change someone's relationship with food so significantly. Although they might lose weight, it might be detrimental to their mental health, for example, or might completely destabilize their world to do this without, you know, the appropriate support around them. So
can I ask you, is the effect on their mental health, is that anything to do with the fact that the gut makes serotonin? Or is that,
you know,
even been
point.
Looked at?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'd say it's so complex that it's probably, that might be one factor.
Okay.
You know, and we certainly, we'd see it less with our business. We'd see how destabilizing surgery is to some people who've gone abroad for surgery without, where there's no multidisciplinary assessment or preparation, and the effect of having the operation, whilst again they might lose weight, but is detrimental in other ways. So someone has to be well prepared, firstly well assessed, and then if they're suitable, prepared for surgery to be able to adjust to it appropriately. So that work is really, really important, to have that multidisciplinary assessment of somebody. And by multidisciplinary, I mean what happens is if someone comes into the clinic in Loughlinstown, and that's where there's a 5-year wait to get that first appointment to see the multidisciplinary team.
So to see the multidisciplinary team, it's 5 years.
So there's almost 5,000 patients currently waiting to get that first visit. And, you know, that first visit might be like that's not a guarantee that someone's going to go on and have surgery. But if they are recommended for surgery, the wait for surgery from that point on is quite short. So that's where we've made progress is okay. Once someone gets in and gets through the weight management clinic, the wait for surgery at the end of that is only about 3 months.
Because I was going to say to you, if a surgery takes an hour and a half, why aren't there 30 or 40 being done a week?
The assessment is so, and it's appropriate that it's comprehensive and slow. You know, I don't mean slow as in, it's just that it's not rushed. You know, it's not an assessment that can be done the morning of surgery. That's inappropriate, you know, or the day before in the cases of people going abroad for it, because you're not allowing any time to identify, if you've identified a problem, to address it. And the kinds of problems that might slow people down would be, you know, I suppose, disordered eating. A lot of people who suffer with severe obesity might have either, you know, as a whether it's a cause or effect of the disease of obesity, but have some degree of disordered eating. That could be a history of binge eating, bulimia, some type of eating disorder. Night eating is another one, you know, and identifying them and treating them. They're not a contraindication to proceeding with surgery, but they have to be appropriately treated. And sometimes the treatment for them can take time. It can take, you know, it's often, the treatments are often delivered by a psychologist or in some instances by the National Counselling Service, and that can just take time to get into that program and then go through the psychology treatment.
So the bariatric surgery can happen once they've been assessed. So is so the waiting list for the assessment, is that because there isn't enough of the multidisciplinary team to assess them?
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's only, you know, to do quality assessments and give each patient the time that they need to, you know, then if there is things to address to, you know, like I said, there's no point doing bariatric surgery on someone with untreated binge eating. That could be harmful to them. So to address that is really important. But similar, you know, there's no point doing bariatric surgery on someone who doesn't understand nutrition, the importance of protein, understand what you'd be surprised. I suppose some people have, you know, really very, very poor understanding of what healthy food is and unhealthy food is, of understanding what protein is, what carbohydrate is, and getting, and, you know, even some, our dietitians are amazing. They'll teach people how to cook, you know, in the clinics in Loughlinstown so that people can cook healthy meals for themselves. So that's really important. This can't be done in, you know, an hour. So people, they'll do a full assessment of what someone's knowledge of nutrition is and their intake. It's also important to discuss, you know, to counsel someone about the import of alcohol, with cutting back on that before surgery, if there's either excess use of it or some, you know, dependence on it beforehand. So it's such a complex area. So the dietitian, psychologist, physiotherapist and endocrinologist will all assess somebody with regards to suitability for obesity treatments, and that, you know, they might decide to start obesity medications, but sometimes they're not affordable to everybody. If someone doesn't have diabetes and they have to self-pay for obesity medications, they're really expensive.
Do you see that coming in where they'll just be allowed, like eventually, you know, when there's enough of them on the market?
Yeah.
Do you see it coming in where it will be allowed easier?
I hope so. Or like, while they're, you know, while they're on, while their the patent exists on the likes of Ozempic and Wegovy, and when it comes in Mounjaro and all these really good obesity treatments, you know. And my understanding is that the patent is that they don't expire for a minimum of 10 years on something like Ozempic. So unfortunately it's not going to be affordable, I think, anytime soon, but it must be. I think it'll be like statins in time. I think once there's generics and competition in the market, I think the cost will go down.
But there's talk now of there actually being tablet forms off whatever as well, which would be easier for some people too.
Yeah, I suppose it's one of those, has always been in pharmacology, one of those challenges to get a gut hormone that's stable in the stomach. So if you think of insulin, like over decades of using insulin, it isn't an oral form of it has never successfully made it to the market. And I think it's similar with these GLP-1 analogues, all of which now are injectable. There is an oral semaglutide, it's just not as effective.
No.
You know, so think there's a huge problem with these gut hormones, the stability in the stomach and in the gut, mm-hmm. that just hasn't yet been overcome.
I've no doubt, though, it may happen, but it's going to take loads of money and loads of research. Yeah,
I'm sure it'll happen, but I hope it happens in our lifetime, you know, that they're affordable, easy to take. Most people don't mind the fact that these medications are injection. You know, I don't know if I've ever seen that be a barrier.
It's actually becoming one of those things now where people are just, they're quite agnostic to injections. Even now, they're, you know, there's some injectable vitamin supplements and stuff now where they're just how good are they? But, you know, there's people who do anything. And with Botox and everything, I think people are just used to, you know, sticking a needle in themselves.
It rarely comes up as a barrier to treatment. Yeah. The waiting list is about almost 5 years to get in the first appointment in the weight management clinic. And from there, someone's suitability for surgery is assessed. And should they be suitable and want surgery, then they can be referred on to meet the surgeon. So that's me or my colleagues, Naomi Fearon or Wacus Butt in St. Vincent's, to have that discussion about the different types of surgery and select the most appropriate operation for somebody. And from that point forward, they might hopefully get an operation within about 3 months. So that's where we've made great progress in getting the, because about 6 years ago when someone got to meet the surgeon, it was still about 3 years to get to the operation date.
Wow, okay.
So we've made great progress in that regard.
And how many surgeons like you are there in the country?
It's kind of the day. There are six surgeons in Ireland with the expertise to do bariatric surgery. Like, they're not complicated operations.
You're selling yourself short there, Helen.
But it's about more than doing the operation, I think, with the interest to manage the disease of obesity, which is, you know, I suppose you become...
You're not just cutting people up all day. You're also managing them as well after the surgery and before the surgery.
Yeah. And I certainly, you know, there's, you know, surgeons who'd have the technical experience to cut the stomach and stitch the bowel to the stomach, but that may not have an interest in the disease of obesity, so wouldn't be the best person to treat somebody with severe obesity. And I know firsthand my husband will be one of them. He's a colorectal surgeon. He could technically do the operation, but he has zero interest in doing it. He wants to deal with cancer. So it's a combination of having the skill set technically, but also having the interest in treating people who live with obesity. And it requires, you know, it's one of the subspecialties within surgery that I love it for the fact that there is a lot of multidisciplinary input for patients, and that you do develop a really close relationship with patient. Not saying that cancer surgeons don't, but there is a mentality of this cancer, chop it out, move on to the next part of the treatment. So I like the close relationship with somebody with severe obesity. That suits me. And working closely with a multidisciplinary team, it's quite a medical, there's a lot of, you know, it's like some people have said, it's the softest type of surgery you could be doing. You know, there's only two or three operations we do over the course of our career, and yet they feel different in everybody because everybody's story is different, everybody's habitus is different. So it always feels unique to me, despite the fact that the technical steps are exactly the same. You know, it's a bit like baking. You know, it's the same every time you do it, but it's just a little different in, you know, the it's the patient that's really unique. So I like that aspect of it. But there are six now. Naomi Fearon, Wacus Butt and I in Vincent's, and then Chris Collins currently in Galway is currently the only surgery in Galway with the expertise to do it, and then in a number of private centres around Culmaboyle in Bonscores and Cork, Will Robb in Blackrock Clinic and John Keneally in the Mater Private.
Okay.
So, and Mylon Arungasaki actually works in Blackrock as well. Sorry. So that'd be that's it at the moment.
Okay.
There's a lot of interest in training in it. So I think now that there is an established career path, we have a training post for a senior surgical trainee in bariatric surgery in Vincent's at the moment. So there is now a career pathway to do it. So I think the problem of getting skilled surgeons is, you know, we've ticked that box. We'll have a pathway, maybe not fast enough at the moment for the demand that there is, but we also need skilled dietitian, you know, dietetic class, the psychology graduates and that. Not everybody will be interested again in doing obesity treatment. It's a very unique skill set somebody needs. So we're, you know, the skill set needs to apply to the whole multidisciplinary team and to endocrinology graduates as well to get a better understanding of the complexity of treating obesity, but also then to spark a career interest in it for some.
Okay.
So yeah, the waiting list is is, you know, not something we're at all proud of, but it's, and I understand it's why a lot of people choose to go abroad for treatment. I think the only solution we have to that is provide a more accessible service here. Mm-hmm. You know, I think...
How much is private surgery here and how long is the waiting list for private surgery?
Yeah, so again, it's quite long in that for most people think, for, I suppose, access to private treatments should be weeks rather than months. It's probably a year in all of the clinics that I mentioned, Vincent's Private, Mater Private, Black Rock, and in the Bonscore in Cork, and probably the Galway Clinic as well. It's a good year because the demand is so high. I suppose the private health insurers have covered bariatric surgery for the last 5 years. So that's made a big difference to people. And I'm not sure if a lot of people know that, but under strict criteria. So the BMI criteria, BMI being over 35 with a obesity-related complication, and the insurers only acknowledge 4 obesity-related complications when they,
what are they?
Are, so diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and sleep apnea. Okay. So even, you know, the fact that someone could be really troubled by awful gastroesophageal reflux, which could be weight related, or they could have, you know, even an endometrial cancer, they could have chronic kidney disease, joint pain. They don't count them as obesity complications. We do in the weight management clinic in Loughlinstown. They're really important obesity complications, but it's those 4 complications that are listed as eligibility criteria. Now, if people, per the private medical insurers, if the BMI is over 40, you don't need an associated comorbidity, you're eligible for it then, but the patient has to have gone through a multidisciplinary assessment for, they have to be in weight management for 2 years and have demonstrated, I suppose, consistency in that in the previous 2 years.
But what does that mean if they're in a weight management program and they don't lose weight? Are they not demonstrating that they're doing what they're told?
It's just, so we have to write, I suppose, supportive letters that patients have, you know, it's terrible that this is requested and asked for. It's a given. Like, most people are in weight management for their whole adult life by the time they come, actually self-directed programs, you know, be that the commercial programs like Slimming World or Weight Watchers, those, you know, do they not count? It's, you know, so I do disagree with the requirement for that, but they're the kind of criteria upon which the insurers will determine whether someone meets the eligibility criteria or not, by which they'll fund it. So we would, you know, write supporting letters. The patients have been in our service for X amount of time, that they have, you know, tried this, that, the other, and that the weight is still, you know, BMI over 40 to justify the treatment for them. You know, and the psychologist has to write a letter to say that they've been assessed and are suitable candidate for bariatric surgery. A lot of it is to protect the patient, you know, but it is to limit the number of surgeries as well that they're funding. But they do fund it in those criteria. Okay. So that is a positive thing. But it's still about, in our service, in Vincent's Private, it's about, you know, nearly 14, 15 months at the minute from entry to an operation.
Okay.
Now, I don't think that's, I'd like it to be well within the year, I think, you know. But again, these are operations that someone should never rush into either, because they're, you know, they're so life changing that really people have to be appropriately prepared, and that takes time, you know. Yeah. And then to have as few challenges afterwards as possible, the education and preparation beforehand is key.
And how much does it cost someone if they don't have the private health insurance?
It's about minimum of 16,000 in Ireland for the sleeve or bypass. And I believe there's a range of somewhere between 16 and 20,000 if follow-up is included as well. So,
and that's for the surgery alone? It's not for the assessment as well?
Probably about 16 to 17 to include the preoperative assessment, the operation. And certainly I can speak for Vincent's Private, I suppose, where the fee for surgery would include a year of follow-up afterwards.
Okay.
We obviously recommend following people up for life, you know, annually after that. But that cost then would be on the patient, or it could be, I suppose, with their GP, if their GP felt able to provide that, as long as there were no problems identified by the time of, you know, discharge from the hospital to the GP at that point.
Okay.
But it's that's unaffordable, you know, for most. Now, a lot of people who've paid for it would say it's an invest, you know, it's the best investment in their health. But it obviously it's about 4 times cheaper in some Eastern European countries, if not more. You can get these operations for as cheap as, you know, less than €3,000.
And just to be clear, it's not just like 16,000 goes to the surgeon. It's like, for the operating, the nurses, the care and everything like that, isn't it? It's like the whole multidisciplinary team that support it?
We've done a number of healthcare economic analyses to assess how, you know, how cost effectively, how I suppose cheaply, for want of a better word, you could deliver these surgeries and still maintain the highest quality in terms of the equipment that you use, the staffing levels, to provide just the best quality of care. So even in the public service, with all the that apply in that sector, the cheapest we could deliver it is about 9,500. So that's taking into account the not even the preparation beforehand, but the surgery, the hospital episode. And just as the consumables, so the things that I use to do the operation, the staples, the energy devices, the just everything to do that set piece is about 2,500, you know, and that's cutting not a single, we've never cut a corner in that, because, you know, I wouldn't want a corner cut if I was having it done, in terms of the quality of the equipment used. And then the time in hospital, all the people that are involved in looking after somebody, from, you know, the best nursing staff who have to, you know, observe them. They are only in hospital about 2 days. But all of that is costly in a healthcare system such as ours. So I suppose then with the private sectors, there's, you know, margin inbuilt for if a problem happens, and everything is slightly more expensive in the private sector then anyway. So there's not much profit, you know, there's almost none there. So it's, they're expensive operations here, but they recoup their cost, certainly to the health service, within 2.5 years. And very few operations do that. So
can I explain what you mean by that, though? Because that's an important point to get across.
So very few operations ever make money back for the health service. So say a cancer operation, you know, the health service doesn't get anything back for doing that. In fact, it probably is just, it's just a cost that's written off to treat an important condition. But with bariatric surgery, because you put so many obesity complications into remission and decrease medication burden for a patient afterwards. So, for example, a typical patient who might come to surgery would be, you know, a person with a number of obesity complications for which they're taking different medications. So take, for example, a patient with type 2 diabetes. The cost of treating type 2 diabetes for a patient who's already on insulin is almost 5,000 a year. So insulin's a really expensive drug. And if someone's on insulin, they're also on probably Ozempic, or for management of diabetes through another mechanism. They might be on 2 oral tablets for it as well. They will also then be put on a statin. They will be put on a blood pressure tablet that could protect their kidneys as well, you know, and to protect their heart, because diabetes can affect or can cause cardiovascular disease. They might be put on another medication that helps improve cardiovascular outcomes. The whole cost of that per year is at least 5,000 now. So if we can put diabetes into remission within 48 hours after a bariatric operation, which happens, we would send a patient with type 2 diabetes home about at least maybe 9 out of 10 cases without any diabetes medications. Their sugars will be normal. They'll be 5 to 6 the morning after surgery, the next morning without anything. And it never fails to impress me. Like,
what?
You know, and that doesn't happen with
operation. If they've got insulin resistance, or it's, how is that?
Yeah, it's just corrected immediately by changing gut hormone, you know, by changing the, you change so many things, like I mentioned before, gut hormones, you change, to some extent you do change insulin secretion, but you massively change insulin resistance immediately by changing the gut in the way that I've described already.
I'm actually shocked that you can change insulin resistance so quickly, like overnight. I would have thought, okay, a month, but.
And it's interesting, he's just actually the guy who first described it, Walter Porres, who's considered one of the godfathers of bariatric surgery in the US. And,
you know,
he trained my US mentor Phil Schauer. But Walter Porres, when he first noticed this in his ward in the States, when he was doing bariatric operations, bypasses for obesity, when the patients with diabetes came along and he was looking at the sugars, the nurses telling him the sugars are normal, he assumed the glucometers are broken. So he tells a really nice story about it, and then so he ordered to throw out all the glucometers, order more, and, you know, sugars are still normal. So then he blamed the nurses and thought the nurses weren't doing it properly. And then, you know, this consistently happened over several weeks of him, you know, observing this trend. And it evolved from there to be, you know, scientifically proven time and time again that diabetes goes into remission within hours after gastric bypass surgery.
But even the fact that the person won't be visiting the doctor as many times,
if they're diabetes. So medication burden
medication burden burden on the doctors. Yeah. So everything is reduced.
Yeah, so all
the
complications.
Isn't there more lobbying for more of these surgeries?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that's only diabetes. So sleep apnea is another important condition that takes longer to treat. But sleep apnea is an expensive condition for the health service to treat. It's treated with CPAP machines that can cost, I believe, up to about 700 euros a month to rent.
I know. I've given it. Well, they go through the drug payment scheme. Yeah. So sometimes people that are on them.
Pay, yeah, you know, it's that burden. So,
explain what sleep apnea is, just quickly, for people that may not know.
People with severe obesity there's a very strong relationship with, so it's sleep disordered breathing. So, for example, what happens with sleep apnea, and again, Dr. John Garvey, the sleep physician of Insomite, would explain this a lot better he's a really interesting person and a world expert in sleep disordered breathing. But with regards to sleep apnea, so essentially what's happening, apnea means not breathing. During someone's sleep, when they have severe obesity, there's periods of time where people are not breathing properly. They've obstructed breathing. And so to, you know, the layperson, that could be really loud snoring. So that's a it's turbulent airflow that causes snoring. So that is, you know, if there's turbulent airflow or poor airflow, manifests as loud snoring. And apnea is where someone stops breathing. And as they come out of that, they kind of have a choking episode or a kind of a loud,
Big loud snore.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So that's an apneic episode. So for people with severe obesity, they can have about 70 of those an hour in severe instances. So that's 70 times an hour. So over once a minute when someone stops breathing for several seconds during their sleep. And that's so disruptive to, you know, their oxygenation, and has significant impacts on the heart.
Can it affect their cognitive function at all?
Absolutely. So that's why people can be really sleepy drivers. So they're having a terrible sleep for all the periods that they're not breathing properly. They're not well oxygenated. So they can then have, you know, it can affect their, not just their oxygen levels, but has a knock-on effect on their carbon dioxide levels. And then they wake up, they don't have a refreshing sleep. They can be sleepy drivers. That's probably one of the most important manifestations and most dangerous manifestations of sleep apnea, aside from the right-sided heart strain that can evolve from it in the longer term. So it's, you know, a really dangerous condition directly linked to it. So if BMI is over 60, it's almost inevitable that somebody has sleep apnea. BMI over 50, about 70% or more of people would have sleep apnea, and it's very much underdiagnosed in Ireland. It's easy to diagnose with a sleep study, and whilst that used to mean somebody had to come into hospital for a night and sleep in the hospital whilst connected to monitors to monitor their breathing, oxygen, carbon dioxide levels for a whole night, now that can be done through a test at home, and simply through equivalent of a smartwatch, a watch pad device. A lot of that information can be picked up, you know, as a good screening tool for us. So, you know, but it's a really important condition. The treatment is, you know, the CPAP, which is a continuous positive air pressure delivered through a breathing mask or through nasal prongs at nighttime. Again, that can be life changing for people who had so many apneic episodes. It can reduce them right down by delivering atmospheric oxygen under pressure, so to maintain their oxygen levels. So it's easy to treat it, but it's better treatment by weight loss. Okay. After about 6 or 9 months, sleep apnea can be in remission in about 2/3 of people, and it can take a few months longer. But about 90% of people will get a remission from sleep apnea where it was obesity linked. Not all sleep apnea is obesity related. Sometimes it's just upper airway issues as well. Like sometimes it's large tonsils or other things that obstruct the airflow. But for a lot of people with severe obesity, it is weight related.
And is that why they say if you lose a bit of weight, you can stop snoring?
Yeah. That's probably sleep apnea going into remission or improving.
Okay.
Yeah, so all these conditions, all of which are expensive to treat, can be put into remission for the long term through a single operation on the gut, which is amazing. So, you know, in the case of a diabetic, the cost to this of the operation, say it's 10,000 in the public service, that's if you're saving 5,000 a year on medications, you have your cost back after 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And then every 2 years thereafter, you're paying for someone else's operation. You know, if you're still not on any of these medications that you were on, that cost is being saved, as well as, again, that doesn't even, like you mentioned, take into account the outpatient visits, the effects of developing complications from diabetes like heart disease, stroke, kidney disease, eye disease, again, all of which have cost implications to both diagnose and treat.
Yeah.
So the knock-on effects, you know, are, and yes, it's an expensive operation. So I think while it hasn't been funded for a very, like to date or until a couple of years ago, is just, I think you have to take a longer term view of the health service to actually acknowledge the cost savings with treating obesity.
Was there probably a little bit of inherent bias there too?
I think a stigma around it. And ultimately, though, to, you know, for any single government who are making decisions about funding a service like obesity treatments, they really have to take more than, you know, probably much more than a 2-year view. So to them, it's really just what is the cost of delivering this right now, you know, and that, you know, was the barrier to funding it for most ministers of health until, and in fairness, Stephen Donnelly did agree to funding this in the budget, not last year, the year before. And that's, you know, and funding several elements of this model of care that, you know, Donal O'Shea and the whole obesity program developed to outline how to best treat adults and children living with obesity in Ireland at every level, from community level through primary care right through to specialised services like the bariatric service. And the government are implementing funding for parts of that, particularly surgical services, one of the first ones to get funded because the effects are so great.
Do you ever operate in children?
I don't know. Historically here, I think I've heard that about 8 to 10 kids a year can be sent to Great Ormond Street in London for obesity operations. But it is a well acknowledged an excellent treatment for severe obesity in kids as well. So with the children's hospital, when that opens, there is an obesity service planned for it, and that will include access to surgery
when it opens.
Yeah.
Jesus, I've been waiting for years.
So,
but yeah, that'll be good. I actually had a paediatrician in, she wasn't a specialist in obesity for paediatrics, but she was saying, like, obesity in kids is very complex because, you know, even turning up for appointments, it can be difficult to get parents to bring their kids to appointments.
Yeah, well, you have 3 patients.
Yeah,
you know, you have
kids. And there's the shame around it as well. Yeah. And the fact that it's so difficult. And then there's some of it socioeconomic, like suggested. Yeah. People don't know how to cook. They don't know what nutrition is because they're not taught it.
Yeah.
So this goes all the way back to, we need more education from the ground up about what we're feeding ourselves. And then obviously I have a huge issue with the way the food industry is allowed to advertise. And the crap that you see when you just first walk into the likes of Deals, say it's all sweets, all crisps, you know. It's just so unfortunate.
It's cheaper to eat rubbish than to eat healthily in a lot of instances, you know.
Well, sure, like a pint of strawberries is €5. You can buy a Big Mac for the same. What are you going to feed your kid? What's going to fill them up more? So I totally get
same
that
fruit and veg is far more expensive than top shelf foods, which are never, you know. And even like I said, and to copy what Donal O'Shea would say a lot about advertising, it's directed at, they're experts, obviously, in targeting their audience. But, you know, how, the checkouts, you know, and I see this now with a 4-year-old, the 10 minutes you're waiting at a checkout lined with, you know, treats, and, you know, it's easier to buy it than not buy it.
Yeah, because they'll have a little meltdown on you as well.
Yeah, and Coke bottles with someone's name on it, like that to a kid means it's theirs. You know, so it's the food industry has a massive role to play in treating, you know, and they can be forced into it in certain ways, like the sugar tax or the tax on sugar sweetened beverages. That actually did lead to a decrease in consumption, and it led to, more importantly, a change in how the companies formulated their drinks. So they did respond to that, you know. So I think there's ways we can force them to make changes, but it takes, you know, a whole, like, you know, multi-sector approach to
it does, because there's so much lobbying and then there's so much money to be made in the food industry too. So it's just, it's all tied up in so much as well. I think that all the stakeholders need to be involved in the conversations, don't they?
And there's not a lot of incentives for the food industry to do this. Why would they? You know, it'll have a knock-on effect in their profits.
Can I ask you about after surgery? What happens to people? Because I've heard hair falls out, you know, and that's obviously due to lack of nutrition, etc. How quickly is that regained? I've heard of the addiction to food being replaced by an addiction to shopping or gambling. Yeah. Can we discuss maybe a little bit of that?
Yeah, and again, these are the, you know, downsides of bariatric surgery. It's almost all, you know, positive to someone's health, and, you know, not, you know, a lot of the benefits are not just weight related. In fact, most patients would actually not even say, you know, when they are, well, I suppose when they're selected for surgery appropriately, the numbers of, you know, stone they want to lose, they don't really have a target that way. They've all health gain goals and certain functions functional goals as well. But then that's balanced by, so they have to be well balanced. So there has to be more benefit than potential risk to the patient. And in terms of risk, I would always tell people, you know, there's short-term risk around the operation itself. So you're bleeding, infection, leak, and I suppose ultimately one of the worst case scenarios is not surviving the operation. So that's one, you know, you have that discussion with patients. But I would also tell them there's a few downsides to weight loss and just to having this approach to weight loss. So the hair thinning one is interesting. I don't know if it's just due to lack of nutrition, because when people do this and they pay really careful attention to their protein intake, they take their vitamins, it still happens. And it's akin to the hair loss that someone gets after childbirth, you know. So it's combination of nutrition, a hormone change.
Hormone change in the gut.
So it's more due to that, I think, than a lack of nutrition. It's certainly worse if someone isn't, I suppose, compliant with their protein intake, their supplement intake. But it's only temporary. So it usually comes on about 3 months after the operation in the phase where that rapid weight loss is kind of, I suppose, acknowledged by the body. And then it tends to last about 3 to 6 months.
That sounds a bit like postpartum. Yeah. Because it happens about 3 months after. Okay.
And it comes back. It's almost always full regrowth afterwards. So it's more obvious in women than men, obviously, with longer hair. Patients would say to me, it's not dramatic for most people. It's like they're brushing their hair and there's more in the brush. It's, you know, very like the postpartum hair loss. Mm. And there's not a lot, like even the supplements we put people on don't prevent it completely. Most people will get some, and some people have it quite extreme, where they've probably really thin hair to begin with, or fine hair, and it's more obvious. I know I've heard Katrina Ryan recommending things like Nioxin or, you know, Regan. So there's some evidence-based things that people can do. Biotin, there's a weak evidence that taking additional biotin with the bariatric supplements can be useful. Mm. But I would reassure people it's almost always temporary. A year later, very few people would ever say it's troublesome. In fact, most people have forgotten about it by then.
Okay.
Then the other two risks with weight loss will be skin, loose skin. And interestingly, gallstones can form from rapid weight loss. But it can happen even through semaglutide as well. So the mechanism isn't quite sure. I think after surgery, certainly with surgery, bariatric surgery and gallstones, there's a change in this hormone in the duodenum called cholecystokinin. This detail you didn't need, but CCK. And that stimulates the gallbladder. So there's a change in that hormone that can have a knock-on effect on the gallbladder and the way it contracts. And that can lead to stone formation. But that is preventable. So we use urso deoxycholic acid, or Urzafoc, one tablet a day for 6 months immediately after the operation to decrease the risk of gallstones. And that decreases it to normal, you know, during that period, to not to zero, but to about 2% in that time from 20%. Okay. So, but we would also prescribe that for people who are having a result from a weight loss result from semaglutide or Ozempic. So that they're the three biggest risks with weight loss, kind of hair thinning, skin loosening, and gallstones. And then that's kind of, I suppose, from a physical health point of view. From a mental health point of view, there are many risks to having bariatric surgery. So for some, as you mentioned, there's this transference of addiction. So where food, you know, there was an addictive component to someone's relationship with food. So it was more than just something nourishing, it's something that they enjoyed or liked. And when you're removed
that... that isn't everyone that has obesity.
No.
What percentage?
About, the literature varies hugely. So about 5 to 7% would get a transference of addiction. And the things that people transfer to vary hugely. Alcohol is one of the most worrisome ones, where people, and about within the first 2 years after surgery, have developed an unhealthy relationship with alcohol or a dependence on it. And it's not always predictable, but it's a really important part of the psychologist's assessment beforehand to see, I suppose, is there any risk factors for this happening? And then to follow people afterwards. This is why follow-up is really important, to identify early if these things are happening, because they're treatable, you know. So that's the important thing with any of these adverse events from surgery, is if in the right follow-up system, these things are identifiable and then treatable. And treatment, again, is usually through with our psychologist for transference of addiction and often through things like cognitive behavioural therapy, compassion-focused therapy. All of those are really successful treatments for these issues that arise after surgery. But it's important that they're identified and something that comes for help when they do happen. And to be aware of them beforehand is really important as well. That'll make someone present sooner. So as well as alcohol, people can develop a shopping addiction. Gambling has got another one. I think the shopping addiction is interesting. It's probably less of an addiction, more sometimes a novelty, that people who've often just, you know, I just never enjoyed shopping because it was difficult. They did it online. They would often never choose to wear colours. You know, they'd, you know, try, and they'd set themselves try and hide in, you know, dark colours, and because they would never get anything to fit them. One of these, what patients call them, got to forget the term, like milestones or anything that's not weight related. So shopping in pennies could be a big one for a lot of women who have it. So to be able to go and do something totally normal like that is, you know, a massive achievement after surgery. Non-scale victories, NSVs. Non-scale, yeah, okay. They're lovely.
Oh, that's a lovely term, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So they're victories, you know, there's so many. I love hearing them. They're
because it shouldn't be about like weight as such. It should be about the health outcome and how they function, feel about themselves.
You know, quality of life, yeah, is probably the most important thing that we achieve in helping somebody to lose a significant amount of weight. And it's everything from air travel to making that, you know, or any type of travel more, not just comfortable, but just for some people achievable for the very first time. Simple as for being able to fit in a bath, paint your toenails, have shoes that aren't slip on or sticky, you know, be able to tie shoelaces, get down in the ground, know you can get up easily. So all of those, you know, non-scale victories are, they're just important day-to-day functions that a lot of people take for granted. It's interesting, my colleague Carl Rue and our department have surveyed people on what the most important health outcomes, or sorry, outcomes overall were for them after surgery, and nobody put weight loss first. It was all health gains, medication burden decreasing, and these functional improvements and the improvement in quality of life that far outweighed, to pardon the pun, the actual numbers of kilos or stones that somebody lost.
Yeah, my goodness. And then I have heard anecdotally now, I haven't done any research in this, sometimes when people go for bariatric surgery and they do lose the weight and they are feeling better themselves, their relationship sometimes with their spouse can be affected severely because their spouse maybe had them in a box that they were this person and now they're shopping in pennies and, you know.
Yeah, and often people, you know, people do change when they lose weight. Like I said, their confidence increases. They feel better about themselves. They feel better about how they look. They become people who might have been introverted or not really not ever enjoyed or chose to, you know, have a social life or to socialise. All of them want to do that because they have the energy and confidence to do so. And that can affect the relationship between couples. So there definitely is an impact on a partner. And that's why it's so important to have a support network. It would be a red flag to me if somebody was doing this against the support of their partner, you know, or getting it over, because that just, you know, that unless they were accepting that the relationship could deteriorate afterwards. But there's other subtle things you might think of, like a lot of couples, part of the relationship is going out for dinners and, you know, it's around food, and that can change afterwards when someone might be not enjoy it to the same extent. A lot of partners would also lose weight afterwards. There's positives for relationships out of it as well. There's positives for not just a partner but a family.
I was talking to some lady, I was down at the bariatric bash there a couple of months ago. I was just giving a little chat or a little talk to them, and one of the ladies said that her whole family lost weight as a result of her bariatric surgery.
Yeah, especially for mums who do it, and they will, a lot of them do it for their family as well. You know, again, they're often so selfless, like they'll do something like this for themselves, but also to be there for their kids and set, you know, to improve their health for their children. And it's really, there's lots of really good data on women who have a kid before they had bariatric surgery, and often then women who conceive and have a baby afterwards. And both children can have, their weights can be, you know, affected differently, or their weight set points can be different because of the, I suppose, the pre-natal state of the mum, despite being in the same environment. You know, it's really interesting.
Have you heard of this whole thing now called Ozempic babies? Have you not heard of this?
No.
So, so apparently in America, where Ozempic is being used an awful lot, apparently
fertility
is increasing because people are losing the weight, and then they didn't maybe
have a lot of surgery babies.
Do you have a lot? Yeah.
And women would often choose this, and, you know, women in their kind of 30s, especially where fertility is a main goal of theirs, or achieving pregnancy is a main goal of theirs, they will be recommended to lose weight or told to lose weight to help their fertility. if they're not conceiving. So often, you know, we would get people who never had to worry about fertility, in that it was a problem for them. Conceiving was just something that never happened. And we've had people within 3 months of surgery get pregnant because they never, I suppose, adopted any precautions. And we're really careful to recommend people that they try everything not to get pregnant for a year after surgery, because it isn't the year after surgery. While there's so much change to nutrition and to the mums, or the female's weight, it's not a healthy time to have a pregnancy. If they can afford to wait, they really have to for a safe pregnancy. Beyond 12 months after surgery is a much safer time to have a pregnancy. Okay. So that's really important. We should probably even go so far as to recommend putting some implantable, like a coil or an implanon or something, in to protect mum and the baby for the first year after surgery. Some units do that. So we'll, at the time of surgery, put in some contraception to be removed whenever somebody wants to, because fertility increases that much and very quickly after surgery. So it's, as I said, an unsettling time to conceive in the year after bariatric surgery, but after a year it's safe. There's a few risks. Like I said, the pregnancies can be deemed high risk after a year still, because you have to pay much closer attention to nutritional intake and supplement intake,
even like the folic acid and stuff. Yeah, you need to make sure you're getting highly absorbable,
and just growth of the baby has to be monitored a little more carefully. Okay. So yeah, you know, pregnancies would almost always be managed, you know, in hospital antenatal clinics, not just all through GP antenatal care, just because of that higher risk associated with having altered absorption and nutritional intake.
Wow. Okay. What do you think of the 360 surgeries? I didn't know much about them until, again, went to the Bariatric Bash. People were showing me pictures and videos of themselves in surgery getting it done, where they basically remove 360. Can you explain what it is and do they do it in Ireland?
So the 360 kind of abdominoplasty would be for removal of loose skin across the lower abdomen, which would also extend around to the lower back area. So the 360 is resection of a whole, I suppose, like a donut of skin and fatty tissue around the whole lower body. It is probably the best intervention for loose skin in that area. An alternative would be like a 180. And I'm not a plastic surgeon, so I'm probably doing this a disservice in explaining it. But would be to do, you know, just more straightforward abdominoplasty to remove the abdominal skin fold. But then people will, for the most part, still be left with folds of skin at the back as well. Now, they may not bother them, but like for people, if they're doing, as you know, strictly for cosmetic reasons, as well as functional reasons, the 360 would be to treat loose skin at not just the front of the tummy of the body, so the lower abdomen, but also loose skin at the back. Because you get loose skin almost everywhere after, like people who have significant weight loss after surgery will get loose skin in four main areas. So particularly for women, the lower abdomen, and that would again include the lower back area, breast skin, because breasts are mainly fatty tissue, so breast skin becomes loose. Inner arms is an area that bothers women a lot, and then inner thighs. So it's a lot, you know, loose skin doesn't just apply to the lower abdominal skin fold, it's all over. So the 360 is removal of this, you know, donut of skin and fatty tissue around the whole body. It's a really maximally invasive operation. It's a lengthy operation, you know, can be 6 hours plus.
It's dangerous as well. It's
dangerous in terms of, like, in some ways it's not as dangerous as bariatric surgery in that you don't have the risk of an intestinal leak or major internal bleeding, but a 6-7 hour operation has its own risks on the skin. So I mean, with the fleur-de-lis or this 360 operation, there's, I think the data is 90% of patients will get at least a minor surgical site infection or skin breakdown, because the skin, to do it properly, the skin is, you know, to root all the redundant skin, the skin then suture back together is under some tension. And as people, you know, heal and then start to mobilize, you know, after a few days and weeks, some of that skin will dehiss, you know, which breaks apart from each other. And that takes, so there'll always be, almost always be a wound issue. 9 out of 10 patients will have some wound healing issue afterwards. That's almost considered normal, you know, part of recovery. When you remove that much tissue, you get this thing called seromas. So fluid will gather where you know in the spaces behind the skin that you're resuturing together, despite doing lots of things to try and minimize that dead space behind the skin. So seromas, wound issues, they're, you know, happen, as I said, up to 9 in 10 people having something as big as a 360 skin removal operation. Then if you're on the operating table for 6 or 7 hours, there's a risk of clotting, so vein clotting in vein, so deep venous thrombosis, which is developing a clot in a deep vein in the leg that can fire off to the lung. That's called a pulmonary embolus. So there's other risks of having an operation that takes that long. So yeah, they're not operations to undertake lightly. They are, again, can be life-changing for somebody who really struggles with even the functional aspects, or you know, the skin rashes, the intertrigo that people get is really, really uncomfortable between deep skin folds. And a lot of people just hate how it looks after they've lost all this weight, you know, and it is holding them back in terms of their confidence, their body image, and their self-esteem.
Okay.
Body image is a really difficult one after bariatric surgery, because often people just don't see any difference in the mirror, you know, for at least a year afterwards. They can acknowledge they're losing weight and clothes size is going down, but often, you know, these surgeries definitely, they don't change body dysmorphia. And actually some people really struggle with not, you know, having a worse degree of body dysmorphia after weight loss because of loose skin.
Okay. And do they do the 360 here? Because I've only heard of it, the people going to Turkey to get it done.
Not to my knowledge. We certainly don't do it in the public sector anywhere that I know of. In fact, sadly, there's no body, with the whole delivery of skin removal surgery after bariatric surgery is called body contouring surgery. So there's no body contouring surgery service in Ireland at the moment in the public system.
Why do you think that is?
So there is an acknowledgement in funding the obesity surgery program a couple of years ago. Like, the Minister for Health did acknowledge it's an important part of the program, and it was planned to be funded in phase two of the funding. Phase one was delivered January of last year, and phase two was to be delivered kind of mid of this year. That's kind of paused for now with staff issues with staff recruitment and the embargo on that. But
a
plastic surgeon is included for the Dublin service, that's ours in Vincent's, and for the Galway service as part of phase two of development of bariatric surgery services. So that's a positive thing. It's acknowledged it's an important part of a level four obesity treatment service, a surgical service. So it's not there at the minute. It will come. I'm confident of that. But in private sector, then again, these are very long operations. So I'm not sure if any of the plastic surgeons in private practice in Ireland are doing them. I know there's lots who will do the abdominoplasty and the brachioplasty, removal of loose skin, the thigh and breast reductions, and the mammoplasties. But I'm not sure about the 360 in Ireland.
And maybe they don't do them all at the same time either.
Yeah, no, and that would be detrimental, like, to have each of those are long operations with all those, you know, wound related issues and risk of DVTs and other, you know, hospital acquired infections, chest infections, things like that. So yeah, I think the most number of areas that should ever be combined, I think, is two, you know, like abdominoplasty and maybe breast and arms, and maybe abdominoplasty on its own is enough. But again, I'd have to ask one of our plastic surgeons.
Okay. And then you did acknowledge the fact that people do go abroad for the bariatric surgery and then the 360 as well, I suppose. What have you seen complications there? Like, you know, because people can't afford it, or else they don't want to wait 6 years or 5 years. Yeah. How, you know.
So, in fairness, it seems to have slowed down in the last few months. And I'd love to think that's from some of the education around the problems that can happen when people go abroad. But there's a really steady stream of hundreds of people going abroad per year from Ireland for it, for the reasons that you mentioned, I suppose. The main one, I think, is that we don't have an accessible service here in a timely way. And then the cost in private sector, if someone was to self-pay for it, which is probably up to five times cheaper abroad. The important thing about that, I think, is, you know, when I've explained how expensive it is to here, is because of the quality of care that's delivered. And I think there is certainly a compromise in the quality of care in centres abroad when reflected in that low cost. It's not just the cost of living difference between two countries. Doesn't explain how it can be five times cheaper, and that is reflected then in the problems we see back, which just couldn't sometimes explain. So I mean, we in Vincent's, we had been getting up until about January 1 to 2 admissions a week with bariatric related problems, and our plastic surgeons actually get a frequent stream of people admitted as well with the complications stemming from plastic surgery. With regards to bariatric surgery, the stuff that we see back is everything from, you know, the things that warrant admission would be, you know, sepsis related to a leak, which is where, if any, you know, when you're changing the shape of the stomach, taking some away or making the stomach pouch and then stitching bowel up to it. So if any of those staple lines or suture lines leaked, if they didn't heal right and gut contents builds out outside of the gut where it shouldn't be. It makes you really sick. So that's called a leak. And the risk exists with any intestinal surgery, even in, you know, in, it exists in our service, in any service, whenever you're having an intestinal operation, that can happen. But the risk should be in the best centres. It's about 1 in 100 patients who'd be at risk of that. If people have had previous operations on the same part of the gut, it's double that. But we just, the types of leaks we see back, you just think there's some compromise in the quality of equipment they might be using. Like, I've seen people with as many as 4 holes along a staple line of a sleeve, you know, people who would be considered easier operations, people who maybe didn't even meet the criteria for surgery. That's my biggest issue with the practice of people going abroad, or the services they go to, is that there's just no selection criteria. Like, we're at pains to implement or, and we're, you know, possibly even too strict on it. Here, like, you really uphold the eligibility criteria really strongly to protect patients, you know, from problems that, you know, that would leave them worse off than if they hadn't had the operation. But none of those eligibility criteria are applied when people are travelling abroad. If you're going to pay for an operation, that's the only eligibility criterion applied. So, yeah, they, like, we've seen, I think the worst things that can happen is someone whose BMI is, you know, we've seen girls is with BMI, pretty normal BMIs, or maybe BMI of 26, 27, so just about the overweight category. You wouldn't even remark on someone's weight, you know, at that, and they're choosing, you know, to have one of these operations. They will get their operation, and if that person has a leak, like, there's just no justification for the operation in the first instance. And also, it should be a really easy operation compared to somebody's weight might be three times that, four times that. So I don't know how that could happen, might indicate that I don't know who's doing those operations or what equipment they're using, what checks they do. When I would do a sleeve or a bypass, and any of my colleagues would, we do something called a leak test. And I like to think we're a bit like plumbers, you know, you put pipes together, you put things together, you would check that it's watertight before you'd leave the operation, you know. So you wouldn't really, if a plumber fix your sink, you wouldn't let him leave without running it and checking it. So we put methylene blue stained saline through the upper parts of the gut. The anaesthetist helps us do that before waking the patient up to make sure that by the time we finish the operations, there is no leak. You know, it doesn't mean that something couldn't evolve in the next day or two, but, you know, you wouldn't finish the operation certainly. And if, you know, stories of people, you know, who come back 2 or 3 days later and there's very clearly, you know, a leak evolving from very early after surgery. So it's hard to explain that.
How would that manifest in someone with just a high temperature?
Initially, fast heart rate, pain that you wouldn't, they're not particularly painful operations. Now, patients, the first night of surgery would disagree with that.
Okay.
The people get, you know, horrible trap. The gas that we use to blow up the tummy to have space to do it leaves people with kind of this really tight band of pain for a few hours afterwards. But almost always I walk in the next morning to someone and they're like, I'm much better, you know.
Okay.
And if people don't say that, you know, or they're still in or worse pain than the day before, I'd be worried there's something wrong, you know. So, and the stories of people who've been abroad is they're in agony from the night of surgery, which usually the pain is severe, but it will respond to painkillers. And people who say they're in agony, the something almost,
and they may not
wrong.
Know, they may just think that that's to be expected.
No, but they're also nursed in hotels, so that's not flagged to anybody. Not in every, you know, I know that people listen will probably say I had a, you know, very good experience, I was in a, you know, fancy hospital, but often maybe the people nurse, you know, nursing the patients or taking the observations may not have anything to do with that, like have any one to go to, you know. I don't know if they, like, our nurses would call me instantly if there's a heart rate of more than 100, or, you know, a temperature of, you know, we've set really strict parameters by which you want to know about a problem if it's, you know, no matter what it is, so you can act early, because with any complication, rescuing somebody from that, the sooner you know it and can fix it, the better the outcome for the patient. You'll rescue the patient from that pretty quickly if you identify it early. And that's what happens, I think. There's that missed period of you lose that opportunity to intervene early when people are nursed in a facility that may not have, you know, staff that are either equipped to or able to pick up on the subtleties of problems evolving. In a lot of instances, when people come back, they say, I did say I was in pain. They told me it was normal. They basically just got somebody out and told them to go to your local hospital as soon as you arrive back. So they knowingly discharge people who were in trouble. And I've had instances where patients have told me, they said that, yeah, I had this problem, but if I was to stay to have it fixed, they'd be charged charge 1,000 a night or, you know, different fees, completely unaffordable. So it's not considered part of the fee that they paid for the operation. So that puts somebody in a really difficult position to travel back sick, you know, on their standard, I don't know, Ryanair flight or whichever, like, so without medical assistance. So it's taking a huge risk.
And then who assumes the liability then? Because that's the tricky part. Because someone has surgery abroad, it's not done well or to the standard of care that it would be here. They get sick. They come and they need to see you or one of your colleagues to get whatever it is fixed. But if there's like, is there a reluctance there to even look after someone? And I know, I don't mean that as in like you just turf them out in the street. But who assumes liability if you go in and you do the best you can, but they're still sick?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't really, like, I mean, anytime you, I suppose, have to intervene on a patient, you're responsible for the outcome from that. And like, we're pretty, again, a lot of the time we're able to rescue patients from that. The ultimate liability, I suppose, is with the person who caused the problem in the first instance. And these clinics, you just can't hold them to account for it. There's no governance. There's no method of recourse for patients, I understand, if anything happens. I don't know if anybody's ever been able to successfully pursue that. You know, like some complications, like there's always a complication, you know, risk with surgery. And like, we get complications, and that's despite trying our very, very best to prevent them. The nature of surgery is every time you know, pick up a knife, and anyone who has an operation will know that there's like, everybody's body responds differently to having an operation. And generally people who, if people have obesity and having one of these, obesity is related to so many health complications that can affect one's ability to recover from an operation. So there is this inherent risk. It's hard to separate that out from, you know, what's negligence or what's, you know, what could have been prevented. Really hard to separate them. So I think the importance of complications, I would always say to somebody that I will do everything I can to decrease the chance of you getting a problem. And then whilst I can't prevent every single problem from happening, I can promise somebody that I will try and identify it as early as possible and fix it. I think that's the best you can do as a surgeon to keep your patient safe and provide the best quality of care. And with practices abroad, I think that latter piece is completely missing, that willingness to identify a problem and deal with it early. Like, you know, some patients say that, oh, you know, I contacted the clinic, they were great, and the surgeon said, yeah, no problem, just go straight to your local service. And I think that's a great service that they were able to get in touch with the surgeon who told them to rock up to the service here for any kind of, you know, any issue, or even for just long-term follow-up. And it does put a huge burden on our services, aside from just the cost. You know, we're not resourced for any of that work at all. So I suppose, you know, there's no room for judgment at all when someone comes in sick. They need your help. They need to get better. And you have to deliver that care. But I suppose, like, on occasions recently, that has displaced one of our patients from Loughlinstown from having their procedure. So if we only have a certain number of beds we can allocate for patients who are having bariatric surgery in our hospital, if they're full with people who are there, having had their surgery abroad and recovering from a problem, that's your bed used. So there have been instances where we can't get our patients in because we're helping people recover from complications from surgeries abroad. And that doesn't sit easily with me, but it is what it is. But that's the knock-on effect.
It's nuanced, isn't it?
Yeah, and the cost of treating a complication is probably 10 times what the cost of doing an operation is.
I was going to say, because there's so much to that. And so, obviously the hospital stay is most likely to be longer, yeah?
It can be it can be up to a year in some, or longer. Like, the complexity of problems people get can be really significant. And some people are, you know, some people just don't have a completely fixable problem. They'll always have, you know, some sequelae from the problem they've had. It's really difficult. But there's a laundry list of issues with the services abroad. Everything from, we've had a number of pregnant women get these operations. Like,
what?
I don't know if, like, here, what? I just find in Ireland, it's hard to get a blood test when you're pregnant.
You can't get a paracetamol when you're pregnant.
Yeah. So one, very
early. I'm joking, actually. Sorry, just in case anybody's. You can. It's probably about the only drug you can get over the counter.
But
when you're pregnant,
have such a fear of treating pregnant women for anything outside of the pregnancy. But we've had a number of women get surgeries whilst pregnant. One quite obviously, so, you know, second trimester, and another where she didn't know, but, you know, amazingly the tests over there didn't pick it up. So that's worrying. We've a lot of issues with people having the, you know, upselling of operations. So they go for plan a sleeve or a bypass, and as soon over there, you know, they're saying, well, if you add in, you know,
boob job.
It'll be this percent cheaper. Gosh. Or if you bring three people with you, one of you get it free. So, you know, 4 for 3 deals is really common. And a lady told me recently that, you know, she went with three of her, between family, maybe sisters or friends, and like at check-in to whichever hospital it was, they were given their, you know, paperwork in Turkish, some in English, but included in the paperwork all of them got was their discharge letter at check-in, you know, so they were, no matter what happened, they were getting the standard, you know, and they all got the same discharge letter. So just no clinical, no governance, no standard, like that's just an appalling, or that it's a good indicator, a reflection of the poor quality of care that's delivered, and that these are just like, you know, they just go through surgeries like a factory. But people get their operation time for like 10 p.m. on a Sunday night, you know, that was the time they were given, and I just don't think it's right to do these. Maybe that's what we should be doing these operations all day Saturdays and Sundays,
24 around the clock. For sure, we don't even have the labour force for that, as we know. And even if we did, we're embargoed.
Yeah, but I don't think anywhere does, and that's what worries me, is who's doing that operation at 10 o'clock at night on a Sunday routinely, and what support services are there, like, you know, nursing wise. And it's never just a surgeon, like it's a huge team of people that it takes to deliver a quality operation, aside from the MDT to prepare and look after someone afterwards, you know. But you have your quality of your highly trained anaesthetist, their nurse specialist, your nurse specialist, your scrub tech, like all of that's required. And then the staff in the recovery down to the ward, like every step is important towards achieving a good outcome. And I don't know exactly what's missing there, but there's major components of clinical care that I think are eliminated.
So it's something to consider when people are going abroad. Yeah, just to like...
Exactly. And I don't think, like, I don't even know how to assess the quality of a certain other surgeon or centre. People can say anything, you know, and how to interrogate that and see if it's true is really difficult. I think there's some indicators of a good quality centre, like, because again, if the surgeon can be amazing and skilled, but if the whole hospital experience isn't, you know, it like that, there isn't trained, you know, nurses to look after somebody, or someone's discharged to a hotel, that's not good. So if the hospital someone is having their care in, the whole episode of care is like, has an accreditation from this body called JCI, Joint Commission International, that acknowledges high quality care across a whole hospital, that's a good quality indicator. So, you know, that would indicate a better quality service. You know, so some people, you could look at some surrogate marker for quality care like that. But I think people still have to think, if I get a problem, what am I going to do? You know, how am I going to navigate that in terms of travel, the cost of that on the patient if they're going to stay abroad, and if they don't, it's a massive risk in travelling back ill. Like, I don't know about you, but I would find it hard to travel in the fullest of health, you know. It's just a difficult thing to do, so to do that whilst really sick is something.
And even the risk of clots, if you've been under anaesthetic for a long time, the risk of clots then after flying is
quite significant. And it is the biggest worry after a bariatric operation. People who have obesity have a slightly higher risk of thrombosis anyway. It's a risk factor for venous thrombosis, as is the operation. So, and actually, remember I mentioned the worst thing that could happen about with any of these operations is that someone doesn't survive it, or survive the 30 days afterwards. So we would call that a perioperative mortality. So that's, you know, the most important outcome after these, and it should be for bariatric surgery as low as less than one in a thousand. And that might seem quite, you know, it's an alarming statistic, but that's the same as a gallbladder operation, the mortality rate for a gallbladder operation. And if a woman's having a hysterectomy, the mortality rate's actually higher for that.
And that's
a knee and a hip as well, a knee replacement, hip replacement. But that's best quality, you know, that's the standard to which you aspire to have a rate of mortality that's no greater than that. But with bariatric surgery, the commonest reason that a mortality would ever happen is that someone got a clot on their lung, a PE, pulmonary embolus, which would usually start as a clot in a deep vein in the leg and then travel upwards to the pulmonary artery, which would bring blood flow back to the heart. So that could cause a very sudden death. So we go to great lengths to prevent that happening. Like from the second someone gets into the operating theatre, we put these special booties on their legs that are connected to a pump that basically massages the calf from the bottom towards the top to simulate calf movement or walking while someone is even asleep to stop venous blood from pooling. And then we even we go further and give a blood thinning injection, Clexane, on the table, and then continue that as long as there's no evidence of bleeding the next from the next day. And then even send someone home with Clexane for 3 weeks or Inohepar, one of the blood thinning, the low molecular weight heparin drugs. Again, for, I've never seen that done abroad. People get, you know, prescriptions for oral anticoagulants, which again wouldn't be appropriate after surgery if someone did get a bleed.
What, like warfarin or Eliquis?
Eliquis, yeah. Okay. Yeah, for like 6 weeks. There's no rationale or evidence for that. So, but nonetheless, if you add an air, like a 4 or 5 hour flight into a bariatric operation in someone with obesity, you've significantly increased your risk of the most dangerous thing happening after bariatric surgery. So, you know, it's hard
to... It's stark when you say it like that, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's something that I don't think a lot of people consider, you know, or even are aware of, the risk that they're taking in that regard. And the problem is, like, the risk is still probably low, but it does happen, you know. And, you know, it's augmented by the fact if a female is on any estrogen-containing meds, if they're on either an oral contraceptive pill that has estrogen in it or a type of HRT, not maybe the body identical dose or the patch form, but the older forms of HRT with oral estrogen, that would significantly increase the risk of clots.
Would you normally
well.
Take people off that their HRT before they go for surgery?
Yeah.
I've had a few women message me that like, I have to go off my HRT and I feel I'll be rotten.
I know. And it's we're so fearful of the risk of ET. And it's funny, I meant to ask, and I still intend to ask Deirdre Lundy about, should you know, what is the risk of for the newer, the formulations?
Identical,
Like, is, you know, because it's, I'm not aware of the data regarding thromboembolism on those, but we're still erring the side of caution and stop anything with estrogen in it because of the association with blood clotting.
I and it's what is it about a month beforehand?
Yeah, after.
So I've women gone. I'm more worried about going off my HRT than actually going
and
for
I had
surgery.
A lady tell me recently she was not good. She was just that it was a deal breaker. She wasn't going to stop it, but was happy to take the risk of a clot. Such would be that it would be so detrimental to her to come off it, which we have to accept that, you know, can only inform her the risk of doing so. So, yeah, I understand that's a difficult thing to do and we're so risk averse.
Of course, but you can understand why.
And most people manage fine. It's, you know, because it's interesting, hormone profile changes so quickly after surgery I think people still go back on it. You know, there's value in that. But it's interesting, estrogen, progesterone, testosterone levels change significantly with weight loss. People can be very labile after it as well. You know, it's hard to attribute that to surgery or the age people are, you know, but this huge change in sex hormones as well after weight loss through any form. Mm. Even we were mentioning earlier, like the impact of weight loss through surgery on the womb is incredible. Like it's the positive effects on the endometrium, so the inner lining of the womb, are phenomenal. Like this, we've treated some womb cancers through bariatric surgery, not through removing the womb. So we've had a good few women referred to us by our gynecology colleagues who maybe, you know, BMI is 50, 60, where they've just identified them to have a endometrial cancer, so a womb tumour. And either the women are, you know, in some instances they're really young and they haven't finished having their families and they really don't want to have a hysterectomy, but they have a womb cancer and that's a recommended treatment. And, you know, it's not experimental, but I suppose there's a huge body of evidence behind it. But in some instances, they refer them for bariatric surgery, the intention eventually being to facilitate safer hysterectomy after weight loss. So hysterectomy can be more risky in someone with very high BMI. The way this, it's having an operation for, it's different to foregut surgery where we position people just the technicalities of it that suit the, you know, heart and lungs better. If, you know, I would position somebody, they're actually, you know, lying down, but I put the bed at a tilt so the gut falls down away from the stomach. So the position I have a patient in is, we call it actually a beach chair position. So someone lies on the table and I can manipulate the table into being like a beach chair, whereas the gynecologists are the opposite. The head is down and the feet are up, and that's not great for blood flow back. So it's a riskier operation for that regard on the heart and lungs. So the lower the BMI, the safer hysterectomy is. So the gynecologist would often ask us to do the bariatric operation first, and then they'll go on and do a hysterectomy when the patient has lost weight. And in some instances, they've done the hysterectomy. There's no tumour there, you know, as little as 6 months after the operation. And now that we're studying it more carefully, it looks like in some women, the tumour is gone at 3 months. Now, the caveat to that is we also place a Mirena coil, so progesterone treatment, and that is good for changing the hormone profile in the uterus, so decreasing the oestrogen drive to the tumour. So, but it's fascinating, like that, you know, bariatric surgery and a Mirena coil can be, you know, I can't, it's not, there isn't robust evidence behind it yet, but it's more than anecdote. There's one published paper recently that, you know, demonstrated quite convincingly that this is a really good treatment for an estrogen-driven womb cancer. Not all endometrial cancers are, but 80% are. And we've had some women keep their womb. And in one instance, I think a woman go on to have a pregnancy afterwards, you know, where the other avenue was hysterectomy. And, you know,
no babies.
So.
Wow. And it's fascinating how the body works and how it's all linked. I could sit and talk to you all day, but I think we have to wrap it up. I was going through all the questions. I think we answered everything just naturally and I didn't even have to think. So Helen, what advice would you give young people today?
Oh God, I was like, I'm no one to advise young people on what to do, but I think, and again, it's some of the advice I was given, it was more like, don't be afraid to set your sights on what you really want to do. Like if I had listened to a lot of, you know, people if I was to follow my head, I would be a breast surgeon now. And ultimately, don't think I'd be as happy in my career as I currently am. So I think, you know, kind of doing what you love is really important. I mean, you know, for me, career is a huge part of my identity. Obviously, family is really important as well. But I think doing what you love, you know, from a career point of view is really important. And I think as well, like, you know, not to be afraid of failure or not to be afraid to do something because it's hard. Again, if I listen to the number of people that told me, you know, surgery is too difficult, certainly for a female, and that I wouldn't have, you know, done it. So don't be afraid to do something just because it's perceived or you're told it's difficult. Every career that's worthwhile, I think, is.
That is so interesting that you said that, because another female surgeon said exactly similar thing, Shuan Murphy.
Really?
Yeah, she said, don't like not do something just because it's hard. It is going to be hard, but it'll be worth it. Yeah.
Anything that's worthwhile is generally hard. And then I remember, you know, when I was thinking of this over the weekend, I was like, oh, my dad always had two really good pieces of, you know, advice for us. I don't know, was it advice or more just statements we were being told? It was like, hard work never killed anyone. You know, it's really basic one. But again, I think it does take working really hard to achieve anything meaningful. And the other one was that I love, and it's kind of meant more to me in recent years, is tomorrow is the first day of your life. So no matter how bad things are, just start again tomorrow, you know. Yeah. And same with, I think it's really been really important in a career in surgery as well, you know. I find it, if a patient does get a complication, and rare as it is, it really gets to me. I take it personally. I find that hard. And I'm glad that I'm in a specialty that complications are few and far between. It's lower risk specialty than, you know, colorectal surgery or transplant surgery. And I'm glad of that, because I couldn't have done them for those reasons. But I think it is important. I do think of them every time I feel like the world is about to end, you know, because something, the day hasn't gone according to plan, or there's something that, tomorrow is the first day always. It can always get better tomorrow.
So right. So right. And what is the meaning of life?
Oh God, I'm too much of a cynic as well to, I think, have any meaningful answer to it. And again, when I was looking it up, I suppose the only thing that resonated with me was, you know, it's for life to have meaning, you know, and for me that's, whilst career is really important, it's family, you know, so like my family is everything to me, and that's husband and daughter and my family, brothers, sisters, and my dad. Yeah. Aww. So I think family and friends, so surround, but doing something you love is a huge part of that, to life have a meaning at an individual level. But I'd like to, I suppose, I'd love if everybody wanted to leave the world better than how they found it in the first place. That's kind of, I suppose, ultimately everybody's aim, or should be everybody's aim, you know, is not just to be a passerby.
I absolutely agree. Helen, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you. You've given us so much information. Thank you so much for your time.
Not at all, it's a pleasure.
This podcast was brought to you today by Boyne Valley Honey. As Ireland's favourite honey brand, Boyne Valley Honey have been spreading sunshine across the country for generations. This year, we're excited to announce that Boyne Valley Honey have partnered with Pieta House to officially become the 2024 Breakfast Partner of Darkness into Light. Pick up a limited edition Darkness Into Light Squeezy Boyne Valley Honey in stores across the country, or follow at Boyne Valley Honey on Instagram to find out how you can support the most important sunrise of the year. Thanks for listening.